Amen. We are going to just do one verse today in Isaiah chapter 66, verse 22. And there will only leave two more in this book to do. That verse reads, "For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, saith Jehovah, so shall your seed and your name remain." Now, hermeneutically, we look at the context of this as we have these last several chapters, and he's talking to the Jewish people. He's writing this to them. And he's saying here that this messianic kingdom that is coming on the earth is going to have a renovation that is going to take place. And then there will be brand new universe after that. This is a renovation. It's a joyous renovation, too. It is very, very happy to know the circumstances surrounding this, what this world is going to be like. God will have renovated this world so that sin will be eliminated. It's never going to control the world again as it does now with leaders, with sinful people, with groups that push immorality of a variety of hosts. Satan will not be allowed to infect this world as he does now. And the great mass of the world's nations are going to disappear. They will be gone. The barriers between areas will be gone. The only nation that will prevail is the nation Israel. World headquarters will be in Jerusalem. And this nation Israel is going to be the same one that was created at the time of Abraham, roughly 2350 BC, when God gave him promises. These promises will be fulfilled, as every other prophecy in the Bible and every other doctrine has been fulfilled up to this point. The walls will come down between nations, and all nations will come to Israel a minimum of once a year. All the Gentiles will be coming to Israel on the Feast of Tabernacles once a year. Now, God has made some irrevocable covenants that are listed in the Bible. And his joy is to see these fulfilled with people that want to follow God. He delights in making these things and keeping these things. And as I said earlier, most modern churches don't teach the Scripture. Most people don't want to learn the Scripture, or they give up. And unfortunately, the covenants in the Bible are not taught very much at all, even in most seminaries. They just ignore them. But there are covenants, and a covenant in the Bible is an absolute God-driven promise. It doesn't depend on mankind. Some of them do, like the Mosaic covenant, but not the general worldwide covenants. Those are promises to this world. We've got the land covenant, the Davidic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, and the new covenant. All are what we call unilateral promises. In other words, God promises to do certain things, and he doesn't care what your attitude is or your response is. He's going to do them. It's not dependent on humans for these covenants. So the first one that he made related to the nation Israel and the world, if you will, are to the first Hebrew, Abraham, about 2350, roughly B.C. He says to him, I'm going to make of you a great nation. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make your name great. And you will be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you and curse him that curseth you. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. And some of you know, in seminary, my final dissertation was about Genesis 12:3, the cursings. Has God cursed the nations that cursed Israel? And the answer is yes. God's promises always prevail. Doesn't matter what an individual's attitude is. See, one of the problems we have as humans is we see people thinking, we see people that are hypocritical, we see people that lie, we see people that go back on their promises. So people assume God's going to be the same way. He's not. Because you can chart these promises over time. Everything that he says, he does. And that's what we're seeing in this one verse today, that the Jews will prevail and persevere and will be running the world in the millennial kingdom. The sins of Israel, the greeds and the greedy nature of the Gentile leaders and kings cause many to just figure, boy, God can't keep his promises or won't keep them. But over time, because we don't know the God, what God's timing is on a lot of these promises. Some of them we do in general, but not specifically. God will always keep his promises. People will deny God because they just say, well, look, he hasn't kept his promise. Maybe not up to today. Maybe it's not for today. But God always keeps his promises. Always, always, always. He gave several texts to us about the perpetuity of the nation of Israel. And I'm going to read the one that is the most concise from Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 35 to 37. And I want you to soak this up as this promise to the perpetuity of the nation Israel. God says, thus saith Jehovah, who giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and the stars for a light by night, who stirreth up the sea, so that the waves thereof roar. Jehovah of hosts is his name. If these ordinances depart from before me, saith Jehovah, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. Thus saith Jehovah, if the heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth stretched out beneath, then I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith Jehovah. Now that is so self-explanatory. Who can measure heaven? Who can measure anything related to this? Will the stars move away? Will the heavens move? No. No. So it's so obvious. Nothing can be done to cast off Israel. And the way he describes this is for all they have done. The sins of the Israelis are just as bad as the sins of the rest of the world. Maybe even worse, because they were given a set of circumstances to live by called the Mosaic Covenant or the Levitical Law, if you will. And they violated it. And you can read through 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, and you can see how bad the leaders were. None of the leaders in the northern kingdom after the split in 931 B.C. were good. They were all horrible. And most of them in the southern kingdom were bad. But here's God saying, for all they've done, I'm still going to continue that nation. Now, we're going to look at 12 circumstances in the scripture and modern history that affirm this. Satan has tried as hard as he can to destroy God's people in all kinds of circumstances throughout the scriptures and after that. And we're going to look at this because he will never be allowed, as God has said, to remove the seed of Israel from perpetuity. When God says something, he means it. The Israelis began with Abraham, 2350 BC. Abraham has a son, Isaac, who's the son of promise. He received the Abrahamic covenant to pass on to his son, Jacob, who is chosen to be the leader of Israel. In fact, his name was changed to Israel. He had 12 sons, and those 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, each had a specific marching order, so to speak, that was given to them, as we see in the 49th and 50th chapter of the book of Genesis, in Jacob's deathbed in Egypt. That's Israel. That is Israel. Israel began then. It's in existence today, and it will be in existence in the future. Now, we're going to start with the first one, is Satan trying to corrupt the seed line, if you will, before the flood. So, before the flood, I conservatively estimate a couple of billion people. Stanford University used some interesting computer models, and they came up with about 5.6 billion people. And I want you to think through this. Just even think of a couple billion people. Everyone got wiped out in the flood except for one family. One family. Satan thought that everybody would get wiped out. They would all turn away from God. That's not what God does, though. The Apostle Paul in the book of Ephesians in his sixth chapter recognized and told us that there's a great spiritual battle taking place. And I've done a series that's out there on sermon audio on the battle for our minds. That's where Satan tries to get us. He tries to shift our thinking, turn us away from God. And he's done that for a long time. Well, what he did, I know there's different views on this, and none of them, except for one, squares with the scripture and the Hebrew text. The fallen angels, Satan's emissaries, left heaven, entered young men's human bodies. As we've seen this in other venues. Book of Hebrews tells us to entertain some strangers because angels are walking among us. Angels appeared to Abraham in human form. It's not that they can't do it. I know some would say, well, angels are sexless, and so that's in heaven, not on earth when they come into earth. They entered these human bodies on earth. They procreated with promiscuous women, and they produced, as the text in Genesis 6 says, a breed of super weird humans called the Nephilim. This is the primary reason that God brought the flood. Yeah, the population of the world had gotten extremely sinful, but this was the worst of it. And what God did was he wiped them out. He destroyed it. Satan thought he could pollute this world so that he would wipe out the line coming through the first parents so that there couldn't be any people of God. It didn't work. God kept one family, and one of those sons of Noah, his name was Shem, he became the beginning, if you will, of the line coming through to go to Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. Satan couldn't do it, but he tried. Then there was a famine in Israel in Jacob's time. Now, Jacob's family was 70 people, 70. God arranges circumstances so that Joseph, Jacob's favorite son, gets carted off, stolen, if you will, or sold to a group of Ishmaelites by his other sons that were jealous. And the Ishmaelites take Joseph to Egypt. So Joseph is in Egypt. He has some dreams, and Pharaoh wants to know what the dreams are and so on. And anyway, the net result of this is Joseph gets elevated to be prime minister because he's so smart and he's got God with him. He shuns the advances of women. He stays holy to God. God uses him during this famine to secure enough grain for 7 years before the famine of 7 years comes. The rest of his family leaves Israel because of the famine, hearing that there's some food in Egypt. And they go there, 70 people in total, including Joseph. They go down there. So Satan thinks, bringing this famine. God thinks, again, no, it's not going to happen. And then 400 years later, we've got this Israeli group that's in Egypt. Now they've gone from 70 people to around 1.2 million or more. Now that's a conservative number. Pharaoh is so upset with these, it was Thutmose II, he figures, I'm going to make them all slaves and they're going to build pyramids and canals and all kinds of things for me. He doesn't like them. He sees them getting more powerful all the time. And that doesn't work because they stay together. They thrive even though they're slaves. So he decides, look, I got a better plan. He tells the midwives, if the baby born to an Israeli is a male, you got to kill it. We're going to kill off the Israelis. Now, this is all Satan. Every one of these is Satan. And it doesn't work because the midwives refuse to do it. They just will not do it. And you know the story of Moses gets hid and he is found and by Abshatshat and taken into the royal palace and so on. And he eventually leads the Jews out of Egypt. They left in the Exodus. God provides a whole host of plagues to force Pharaoh to get rid of the Jews. And he does. So the Jews begin to leave. And again, there's 1.2 million of them. I can't imagine that many people in one group leaving one area. They get to the Red Sea. It's actually the title in Hebrew is the Sea of Reeds. It's not the Red Sea per se, but they are led at night by a pillar of fire and led by a cloud during the day. They get to the Red Sea, and God opens the Red Sea. He moves the Shekinah glory behind the Israelis so the pursuing Egyptian army cannot see the Israelis in front of them. And they move across the Red Sea on dry ground. They get across the Red Sea. God then closes the water back up and he drowns the entire Egyptian army that was following them. Again, there was about 1.2 million Israelis. Pharaoh thought he could get rid of them. He tried various means. Ultimately, he thought he would attack them. The Israelis were not military people at that time. And he went after them with his army. It didn't work. It didn't work with the midwives. It didn't work by enslaving them. God says Israel will always exist. After the Babylonian captivity, the Jews were in Babylon. Now, they got to bear in mind, they've been there 70 years. There's a lot of Jewish people there. And the Medes and the Persians took over. And a story we see in the book of Esther is that Mordecai was the only Jew that was allowed into Xerxes' court. The rest of them were all Gentiles. Now, Mordecai's job was to represent the Jewish people and the court. It would be the government of our time, if you want to be. And there was another guy, Haman, who was closer to the king, and he wanted to kill all the Jews. He was led by Satan. He wanted to kill them all. And he figured, well, Mordecai did not bow to him when he ordered him to do it. So Mordecai says, being a Jew, I'm not bound to you. Who are you? You know, you're not God. And that really upset Haman. So Haman and his wife Zeresh, they institute this plot to get the king to kill him. They set up gallows. They're pretty firm in what's going to happen. And Esther becomes the queen, and she petitions the king, and everything changes. It's Haman that gets hung on the gallows. It's not Mordecai, and the Jews continue to thrive through the Second Temple period. Moving on, we get a series of activities associated with the Roman rule that starts in 63 B.C., one of which was after Pompey came in, he took control. Some Jews rebelled. They were put down. The biggest rebellion happened in 66 AD. It lasted for 4 years. And almost all the Jews were exterminated in Jerusalem. Almost. This city of Jerusalem was going to remain in Roman hands for about 600 years, one form or another. Following that, the Byzantine emperors took over. They ruled the holy city from 638 by the Muslim Caliph Umar until the last caliphate, which was the Ottoman Turks. The Ottoman Turks were dissolved in the First World War. They made the biggest mistake. Bear in mind now, the Muslims hate the Jews. They have publicly stated that they want to exterminate the Jews. They don't make any bones about it. They don't deny it. It's not twisting their language to make that statement a fact. I've got quotes that they have said publicly, we want the extermination of the Jewish people. So the last caliphate ends with the First World War. They don't get to exterminate the Jews. The Romans are no longer a world power. They couldn't do anything beyond what they did. The Ottoman Turks lost the caliphate. Their biggest mistake was they sided with the Germans in the First World War. They figured, well, the Kaiser is pretty powerful. We'll side with him. They lost. It's done. The Jews started coming back in the Zionist movement, and the Muslims have vowed to exterminate them still. And then despite all odds, the nation Israel was recreated as a politically sovereign state. Leviticus 26, verses 44 to 45 says, For all that, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them, neither will I abhor them, to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them, for I am Jehovah their God. But I will, for their sakes, remember the covenant of their ancestors, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt, in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am Jehovah. So as a direct result of the Nazi Holocaust, when the world saw this, that when the Allies came into these concentration camps and saw what had happened, General Eisenhower had thousands and thousands of feet of film shot and millions of pictures. And this stuff is still out on YouTube and the internet and other places. The world's sympathy was at its height for the nation Israel. They said, we got to give these people a land. We got to give them a land. There was all kinds of ideas about where, and they ended up giving them the piece of property on the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. The United Nations voted 33-13, and there were 10 people that abstained. The area was given to them. It was called Palestine. And there was an Arab state created, and about 75% of the land was all desert. They made it green, and they grew food in the Jezreel Valley that rivals any other place on earth, even the San Joaquin Valley in California. The Arabs rejected this, even though the United Nations voted overwhelmingly in November of 1947 to give them that property. So on May, the last British forces, 1948, left the Jewish Agency, as it was called. It was led by Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. He declared the State of Israel in accordance with the 1947 partition plan that the United Nations had developed. And Joseph Stalin and, believe that or not, and Harry Truman immediately recognized this state as being a sovereign, independent nation with whom we will have trade relations and economic and political relations with. It's hard to believe. I mean, I can see Truman doing it, but because he was a Bible exegete, if you will. He knew the scriptures well. But I don't see Stalin doing it. But he did. He did. He did it right after Truman. And what happens is the Arabs rejected it. They said, no way, it's not going to happen. And in 1948, right after this happened, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, and Iraq invaded Israel. Now, despite the advantages in numbers, organization, and weapons, the Jews began to overtake the invaders because they started invading before the final declaration in May. They started invading in April. And the Israeli Defense Forces had not been formed yet. It was called the Haganah at that time. And they captured several towns, Tiberias, Haifa, and they temporarily opened the road to Jerusalem. They had no weapons. They hadn't had time to be organized and do this. Czechoslovakia was the only nation that gave them armaments. And those armaments were from World War I. They were used. They were 30-some years old. And they beat back everybody. God says Israel will prevail. Nothing will stop it. Jordan captured what is now referred to as the West Bank. And really it's Judea and Samaria. And they took the eastern half of Jerusalem. 1949, Israel had prevailed so much that they forced Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Transjordan to sign armistice agreements. Transjordan changed its name in 1949 to be just Jordan. There never was a nation, Jordan, before the 1940s. Jordan annexed Judea and Samaria, and only Britain and Pakistan recognized this annexation as legitimate, which that's what caused it to prevail, because most of the other nations says, wait a minute, these guys attacked Israel. We're not going to let that happen. Didn't matter. They gave it to them. The region of the east side of Jerusalem became a seedbed of terrorist organizations, the Haganah, or not the Haganah, a whole group of people that the Haganah was fighting against, and then the Israeli Defense Forces. The raids that came out of there brought forth a brand new era of terrorist activities and a desire to get the liberal media of the United States and other Western nations to side with the terrorists about how persecuted they were. I know I've mentioned in the past a story of Joan Peters, who wrote from time immemorial. She was an independent writer and had a historical background. And it was either Random House, I think, or Rand McNally, one of the big New York publishing firms, came to her and they said, look, we want you to write the story of these poor Palestinians. They're getting persecuted by the Jews. That's terrible. What's going on over there? And they gave her a substantial down payment. She came back to them and said, I can't write your story. I gave you your money back. And they said, what do you mean you can't write the story? They're not persecuted. They're persecuting the Jews. And they said, wow, it sounds like a better story. Write that one. Well, if you haven't read that book, it's really an interesting book. And she details everything that happened after the War of Independence about how the United Nations had issued all kinds of decrees. And these nations that are surrounding Israel, including this so-called group of Palestinians, all persecuted the Jews. Later, on the morning of June the 5th of 1967, the Israeli Air Force destroyed the Egyptians in the next war. The next war was the 67 three-day war, where the Egyptian Nasser, he ordered the Straits of Tehran to be blocked, which is their access, the Jews' access to the ocean to get their trade out. It's the biggest access. They had the Mediterranean, but the biggest one was through the Straits of Tehran. Well, by doing that, Egypt moved 100,000 troops, 1,000 tanks, and 500 heavy guns into the Sinai. And the Arab forces outnumbered Israel 3-1. The war was fought on three fronts. The south was fighting the Egyptians. In the middle part of the country, it was the Jordanians. The Jordanians were told not to fight. They said, don't do it, don't do it. Nasser's lying to you. They did it anyway. And the Syrians in the north. The Egyptians were defeated. The Jordanians were defeated. And they had to give up Judea and Samaria as a result of this. And the Syrians were defeated. The Syrians then had to pull back from the Golan because the fighting up there was pretty fierce. Almost the entire Egyptian Air Force was decimated by the Jews. Almost all of it. Nasser admitted it later on. Ariel Sharon launched this lightning attack. More than 800 Egyptian tanks were destroyed, thousands of soldiers taken into as prisoners of war. 80% of the Egyptians' military equipment was decimated, and it all came from Russia. Just think about this. Russia is supplying the Muslims and the Arabs. The United States, on the other hand, started supplying the Jews. And there was a fear that this was going to cause a war between the Soviet Union at the time, the Soviet Union and the Americans. From 48 to 67, Jerusalem was a divided city. And it then became all within the confines of Israel. And the biblical cities that these Jordanians had became back to Israel, Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, Bethlehem, and Hebron. And Egypt's ally in the north was Syria. And what the Israelis did was they landed troops behind the Syrian lines up in the Golan, and they fought them in two different directions. Then they brought their bulldozers in to bulldoze away the landmines, because the landmines weren't going to hurt the bulldozers, and the men driving the bulldozers were secure. And the Air Force prepared the way to land troopers. It was just amazing to watch these things. And, you know, I remember this happening, but I didn't know exactly what it was that was taking place there. And my father was he was a military historian as a hobby. He really admired the Jews. He said, never have there been fighting troops like these guys. He said the Germans weren't even that good. He was just amazed. He said, something happened. They got this power, this acumen, this ability. You know, and we look back now, we know it's God wanting this to happen. That's why it happened. That's why it happened. Then suddenly, in 1973, the same groups attacked the Jews on the highest holy day, Yom Kippur. And it was October the 6th, 1973, when the Jews were praying and fasting, and they were taken, they took this one hard because they lost a lot of people. And the Egyptians refused to accept a ceasefire when the Jews started getting stronger. They got a Soviet airlift. The United States, again, sent an airlift to the Jews. And by October the 10th, and just bear in mind now, this is only about 4 days, the Israeli forces succeeded in pushing the battle fronts back. They advanced beyond the 67 lines into the Syrian territory. The Egyptian front, the Israelis succeeded in crossing the Suez Canal. They surrounded the Egyptian Third Army. The fighting continued. This almost brought, again, the U.S. and the Soviet Union to war. I remember this one well. And as the result, the Arabs figured, and the Russians figured, we can't beat these Jews, and we can't beat the Americans. Let's cause an economic disturbance, and let's have a political and a campaign, a public campaign in the media against them by lying, deceiving, and sending out these negative messages. So Saudi Arabia turns off the spigot of the oil, and we were buying a lot of oil from them at the time. And a lot of you may remember the oil embargo. Just big lines at gas stations, you couldn't get gas and whatnot. It lasted a while. These are all efforts that Satan has put in place to try and take the Jews out, to eliminate them. God says, no, it's not going to happen. The greatest one is yet to happen, and that's what this Antichrist, this one world leader, at some point in the future, is going to try. He will be led by Satan, the god of fortresses, if you will. That's what one of the terms. He's going to have a policy that might makes right. He does not know God. He does not love God. He's going to deceive the Jews and enter into a covenant with them. God says he hates the covenant. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He just has some terrible things to say to the people that are going to do this. And we looked at this earlier on in Isaiah chapter 28 when we were there. The Bible doesn't disclose the exact nature of the covenant. It's just he's going to make some sort of a deal. Some reasonable speculation is that he's going to allow them to build their temple. He's going to give them the Temple Mount back, take it away from the Muslims, but we don't know that for sure. And that starts the tribulation. That is the timing of the tribulation, is the beginning by the date that will happen at some point in the future where he will make a treaty with the nation Israel. In the middle of the tribulation, the halfway point, he's going to go into the Holy of Holies of the temple. He's going to declare himself deity. The false prophet will have made an image, and that image is like a Pinocchio or Edgar Bergen's puppet of some sort, an inanimate object in the form of the Antichrist. Satan causes that thing to come alive. And that is the abomination of desolation. That is going to be the midpoint of the tribulation. He then turns, the Antichrist, that is, turns against the nation Israel and begins to persecute them. He is the worst of the worst of dictators that have ever been on the earth. We, again, will not be affected by any of this because the church is guaranteed not to see the wrath of God, the tribulation. Genuine believers off the earth, there's nobody here to push back on these unwholesome activities, these immoral activities. So this goes on, and it goes on, and the Antichrist will then begin to persecute the Jews to the point of killing 2/3 of the nation Israel during the tribulation, during the last half of it, just the last half of it. Jesus in Matthew 24 gave a warning to flee. We've looked at that in the past. It's to Bozra, southern Edom. That's Petra today. Those Jews that become believers and are reading the scriptures are going to realize this and they will flee. Most people won't pay any attention and they will be killed because 2/3 are going to die. 2/3 are going to die. In the Holocaust, 1/3 of the world's Jews died. You know, you think about that, 6,000 plus people, Jewish people, died in the Holocaust. It was a an industrial level genocide that they had set up. They had a number of extermination camps, and that's all they were doing, was trying to mechanize the whole process where they would be killed. Well, the Antichrist is going to do it even more. He's going to kill 2/3 of the Jews. Zechariah 13, verses 8 to 9 says, "And it shall come to pass that in the land, saith Jehovah, two parts thereof shall be cut off and die. A third shall be left therein, and I will bring the third part into the fire and will refine them as silver is refined. And I will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, Jehovah is my God. So after a significant loss, Christ is going to do just exactly what he said. For he said in Matthew 23:39, for I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. So the Jews' willful disobedience toward God finally dissolves, and the worst persecution that this world will have ever seen. Nothing is going to be as bad as the war of this tribulation. We have had successive wars growing in intensity and frequency, where the whole world was at war. In the last century, we had that happen twice. And the Second World War was far worse than the first. This is going to be far worse than any of them altogether. It's going to end with peace and prosperity of the Messianic Kingdom, where Jesus will be running the world. And finally, the prophecy that he gave them way, way back in 1440 BC will be realized in Jehovah saying, in Deuteronomy 28:13, it was recorded, and Jehovah will make thee the head and not the tail, and thou shalt be above only, and thou shalt not be beneath. If thou shalt hearken unto the commandments of Jehovah thy God, which I command thee this day to observe,